Okay, well, last week you were talking about the justice of God.
Right.
Now, there were, and I won't say a number of people, but I was asked about this, and I would ask for you to respond regarding your statement in the area of the Jews being somewhat passive in their being pacifist rather than aggressive when it comes to governments, et cetera, et cetera. Now, does that make sense to you?
Can you give me just a little bit more of a...
Okay, Marvin, give me some more. Well, come here. And I'm going to let him tell you. So I knew I'd get him in there. I'd sucker him in. He didn't want to talk. All right, this is Marvin Hyde. Okay, he's going to tell you what the impression he got.
You were speaking of the...
Hello?
Okay. You were speaking of the militia groups and that...
Oh, yes, right. That's correct.
And that you couldn't see where the government would tolerate them in their
right.
existence when they are vocal against the government. To me, living in the society we live in, I don't understand that. And
okay.
then you have to balance that against, you know, the Torah society, which is the perfect state that we're not at yet. Then, in all of that, I see that... when you look at the nation of Israel, they've been passive so long. Why does this opinion seem to be there? And, you know, there comes a place where if you don't stand up against evil, then it'll just totally overrun you. And do you wait for God to do it all, or do you take part yourself?
Okay. All right. Now, let me address that question. The first part I don't understand too clearly, but... let me say this. What I mentioned last week is that God, you see, when people ask questions like, how could certain things happen, you know? Like, why didn't God save the children? What I tried to explain last week was that according to Torah, the challenge of man, the challenge that God placed before man, is to use his mind, his intellect, his rationality. And that's why God placed them in a rational world. Now, when you have a rational world, man has to use the tool that God gave him, namely his mind, in order to be able to understand how this rational world works and use his mind, not his emotions, his mind, and then he can be successful. Now, what I said last week was it would be impossible for God to create a rational world and then at the same time have this world work irrationally, which means if somebody would throw a baby out of a window, suddenly the baby would fly up in the air. Then laws of gravity would not exist. Now, God does not change the laws. The laws are here, all the laws that the prophets speak about, the laws of nature. And by the way, the prophets are the first ones to ever speak about the laws of nature. It wasn't until much later, I believe it was Newton, that came with the concept of the laws of nature. But the prophets had the concept of the laws of nature. The laws of nature are are God's creation, and it's part of the rational world that he created. We're supposed to study and understand how these laws work, because these laws work with divine wisdom, and we're supposed to live according to in the framework of these laws. Okay, and also laws concerning the human mind, psychology, and everything we do is supposed to be based on understanding. Now, therefore, God does not interrupt the given order, because then the whole challenge of life would be impossible. Then we'd be facing a world that's irrational. Things, rocks would be flying up instead of down. Things would be working arbitrarily. So God does not intervene in this system, because that is our challenge, to live with our wisdom and our knowledge according to the world that God gave to us. So it is impossible, it would be impossible for God to give us a world that works according to rationality, expect us to use a rationality, and at the same time keep breaking these laws, which would mean we don't live in a rational world. So the fool would have the same effect, as it would have the same result as the wise person. That's what I mentioned last week. Now, I did not wish to get into political issues. I know everybody has their own opinion in politics. I just try to teach Torah, so I just used an example. What I said was that there are two in the Torah. If you trace if you look at the ideas of the Torah, you'll see there are two responsible entities. One is the individual, and the other is society. And that's why you have in the laws and the seven laws of Noah. You have the seven laws of Noah are spoken to two entities. One is the individual. That's the first six laws. But then that seventh law is a law that is spoken not to an individual, but to the society. A society is a responsible element. Now, when you say it's responsible, it means that it can do harm. It can kill innocent people. If that were not the case, in other words, every time an innocent person was about to die, somehow magically God would save him, again, you would not have a rational world. So that would be impossible. And as Maimonides says, God does not do the impossible, and we do not maintain that God can do the impossible, because the impossible is impossible because God dictated that it is impossible. So it's God's wisdom that makes things impossible, and God does not do the impossible. So therefore, it would be impossible for God to give us a world that doesn't work, that he constantly changes and expect us to see wisdom over here. We wouldn't be able to study laws. So therefore, once there's responsibility, if man is charged with responsibility, it means he can destroy his life as an individual, or a society can destroy lives, and a society can destroy innocent lives. The statement of the Talmud is that the righteous are taken by the sins of the generation, which means the righteous can die. If a righteous person could not die due to a society cannot be responsible. There wouldn't be any responsibility. It means you can be totally irresponsible and everyone's going to be fine. That's not the way things work. We have responsibility, and we have to live according to rationality. Now, I just gave an example. I said, in my opinion, our government many times protects the criminal rather than the good person. And I said that I can understand rights of freedom of speech and rights of privacy, but when you see a group whose philosophy is overtly anti-democracy and anti-government, to say that these people cannot be investigated because this would represent an infringement on their privacy, to my mind, is senseless. Does not make any sense. And I know that in the 70s, originally, you know, the government used to investigate these groups, and that's why this never happened before. But then in the 70s, they changed the law, and they said, no, they have rights of privacy. So if we're going to accord rights of privacy to belligerent groups that are crazies, basically, they're not operating according to rationality, then I say that we are responsible. We have a responsibility. And now if evil occurs, we cannot say, well, why didn't God save those children? Just like you cannot say, well, if you go to sleep and you're living on the fifth floor in an apartment house and your children fall out the window, well, why didn't God catch them? Because then there would be no human responsibility, and we would not be living in a rational world. And that is not the world that God created for man. The moment God placed man in a rational world, it means there's cause and effect, things work according to rationality, and you are responsible. And if you live a certain way, you're going to have a certain set of results. If you live another way, you're going to have another set of results. Now, with regard to Jews being pacifists, in my opinion, I agree. I do not believe that is the proper mentality that the Torah describes. The Torah does not describe a pacifistic mentality. The Torah describes a just mentality. King David was not a pacifist, he was a just man. Neither were any of the heroes, the great heroic figures of the Bible. But, again, I mean, there are, you know, the question of how to act in a given time is many times is very subjective. Everybody has their own opinions on it. And halacha really cannot dictate the political reality. Halacha, the Torah, recognizes all areas of knowledge. The Torah does not tell a person what kind of medicine to take. It tells a person to go to the physician. So if you want to know something about warfare, you have to ask a general. The only thing we do say about the Torah personality is that a great Torah personality is most adept at thinking unemotionally. In other words, if you go to a great Torah mind, because of his practice in the study of Torah, his mind has been trained how to think in a way that emotions do not enter the picture and do not cloud the situation, because that's the training of Torah. So we say such an individual, if he is, given all things are equal, he will be able to give you the most rational approach. But of course, you have to have the knowledge of the specific situation, and Torah personalities don't always have the knowledge of the specifics in every area. So we do recognize the importance of consulting Torah personalities when they have the information. That we do recognize, although halakhically it's not binding. One does not have to follow a Torah personality except in the area of halakha. I mean, it's not binding. But the Torah does recognize the fact that a Torah scholar is one who is wise in all his endeavors, as the prophet says about King David. And David was intelligent, wise in all his ways, and God was with him. And as we find in the beginning of Joshua, that God says to Joshua, if you follow the ways of the Torah, you'll be wise in everything you do and you'll be successful. So you see, the Torah has transference value to every area of thought. But of course, as I said before, you have to have knowledge of the area of thought. And I don't claim to be a political scientist. So therefore, I am not saying that everyone has to agree with my particular position that I just expressed before. Nevertheless, I'm using it as an illustration that if a society does not live in a rational way, then evil will befall even the righteous in that society according to Torah, and God will not necessarily save, intervene, and see, certainly will not intervene and save every righteous person. This we see from the story of Sodom, where Abraham asked God, how many people in this society have to be righteous in order for you to protect the entire society? And the lowest number was 10, which means that there could have been 9 righteous people there, but they would perish in Sodom, which means that Sodom has a responsibility for those righteous people, and God will not intervene necessarily to save their lives. He can, but he not necessarily. I mean, you know, prophets were killed also. Isaiah was killed, and even prophets were not afforded protection by God, divine protection in many instances. But the Torah teaches us one thing. We have to look into the Torah to see the kind of world that God gave us, and we cannot simply sit back and wish a kind of world that we want. That is a childish thing, which religions, man-made religions, always do. They make up these fantasies. They decide what God's going to do, what he's not going to do, and then they make up all kinds of crazy things. If I shake and go into a fervor, the snake's not going to bite me, and all these other kind of nonsense. Because they wish a world which they want to see. But the Torah, the individual who studies Torah, does not do that. The Bible is the book which teaches man what God's world is and the framework which he gave us to live in. And we have to accept that. That's God's wisdom. We may want God to intervene and protect the man from every tragedy. Unfortunately, I shouldn't say unfortunately, because God's wisdom is supreme, but I'm just saying it in jest. Unfortunately, that's not the way the world works, but we have to conform to the world that God has created, and the way, the whole story of everything the Bible talks about is, it teaches us when God does intervene, when he doesn't intervene. When does he save a righteous person? When doesn't he save a righteous person? We may, of course, would be very nice if he'd always save a righteous person. That would be our idea of the proper way to run the world. But that's not the way God runs his world. So we have to subordinate ourselves to the way that God runs the world. And God judges individuals, and he also judges societies. And in the judgment of societies, a righteous person can be caught. And that is a fact. The Torah does not describe any kind of mystical. There was Rabbi Chaim Zimmerman. He passed away recently. He was a great Torah scholar, and he made a statement which, to my mind is very accurate. He says there is no such thing as Jewish mysticism. That's a misnomer. Jewish is not mystical. There are Jewish mystics, but there's no Jewish mysticism. If you look at the Bible does not present any kind of mysticism. People have projected mysticism onto the Bible, but if you just look at the words of the Torah itself, you will not find any kind of indication whatsoever. As a matter of fact, it's exactly the contrary, and the Torah always abhors any kind of powers other than the Creator himself. But people keep on projecting because people have very cherished beliefs. This stems from the primitive part of man. The most difficult thing for man to do, whether it's Ben Israel or Ben Noach, is simply to accept what the Torah tells us about God and how he runs the world, because it's not going to be in accordance with our private emotions. And that is really the challenge of life, is to be able to accept the reality that the Torah teaches us about God and not the childish notions that we have about how God should do things. This is primitive, and this is what every religion teaches and espouses. Just to give you an example about the people believe that there are powers in the stars and the planets. They have effects on us. Does the Torah say anything like that? Take a look in the beginning of Genesis. What does it say? It says that in the fourth day that God said that all these planets and the sun and the moon and the stars that relate to man are there for one purpose. They're for signs and for days and for nights and for seasons, which means to say they simply have a practical function. That's all. That is the greatness of Torah, is that you see there was no nation for centuries and centuries, more than 1,000 years, which didn't have astrology, except the people of Israel, because they got it from the Torah itself. That is absolute nonsense. That there are no powers out there, and the stars have no powers, the planets have no powers. These things were created by God because they help man. These things were created, the ones that, it's not speaking about the entire universe, it's just speaking about the part of the universe that affects us. And this was programmed into creation that we should, that our planet should have a sun, a moon, and the stars, the various stars, so that a person is on a ship, he could see a north star, it's a sign, he knows the direction. This was all pre-programmed into creation so that man can have what he needs, and it only has a functional value, but there is no other value there. But as much as the Torah says, and by the way, if you look at Psalms 104, he says, what did he say? He says God created the moon for in order to be able to determine time periods, a monthly cycle. And Psalms 104 is a beautiful psalm where he describes nature, and he shows the ecology is all created with God's wisdom, and everything in nature has its place. And he mentions how the multifarious type of life that exists in the sea, and the nighttime in the forest, and the various animals who live at night, and different ones who live at daytime. It's one of the most beautiful psalms. I think that it was written centuries and centuries ago, thousands of years ago, and yet you can read it today, and it has such beauty to it, and it shows you how everything is created with God's wisdom, and the planets and are all there for man to have seasons and day and night, and that's the only purpose of these things, and it's all part of God's infinite wisdom. There are no forces, powers out there. This is all primitive type of nonsense. And that's why I say that the people will always project onto the Torah this kind of primitivism, but there is nowhere in the Torah itself that such ideas are expressed. On the contrary, the Torah expresses ideas of the most profound type. It recognizes the laws of nature, and it recognizes the fact that man's purpose in the creation is to understand nature, to use his mind, to use his intelligence, intelligence, and then to understand Torah. And the Torah itself prohibits any kind of activity which is nonsensical, irrational, and is man-made. By the way, if you look in the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, they will tell you that there's no such thing as a definition of religion. I don't know if I mentioned it, but I will tell you a definition of religion in my mind, which is a definition, and there are various definitions that were given. They all have difficulties. I think there's one simple definition, and I don't see any difficulty with it, because I think it's true in every religion. The definition of religion is when man tries to act in a way that he's doing something which he thinks is a cause that's going to affect something else, but this cause has no basis in reality whatsoever, which means a person will sit in a trance and think that by going to this trance, he's going to help somebody be healed. In other words, it's invoking causality, trying to use causality in a way where there is no real causality there, according to reality and according to the human mind. So it's a foreign kind, it's an attempt to introduce a foreign kind of causality that doesn't exist, basically, except in the fantasy and the imagination of a human being. And the Torah is very much against that. There is, I'll give you an example, a question came to me this week that was supposed to go to a graduation. And he said, well, what's wrong with going to graduation? Well, there's a problem, according to Halacha, because in graduations, people wear caps and gowns, and special caps and gowns. Now, there is a big question in Halacha, a debate, actually, among two groups of scholars. The Tosafists prohibit one from engaging in any kind of ritual action, which means, you see, we don't have any rituals or ceremonies. We only have Halacha. And any kind of ceremonious action is prohibited. The Tosafists say as follows. They say that there are two kinds of ceremonials among the nations. One type is religious ceremonials, and this certainly is prohibited because that's idolatrous. But the other kind he calls ceremonies ceremonies of stupidity and nonsense. Which means basically that any kind of ceremony that's man-made is totally nonsensical and prohibited, according to the Tosafists. There are those that argue with the Tosafists, and they maintain that as long as it's not of a religious type, it is permissible. Okay? This happens to be an argument. But according to the Tosafists, any kind of ceremonial is prohibited, which would mean a graduation ceremonial. That's basically a nonsensical thing. It's very sensible to study and to learn, but the ritual of graduation where you have people marching down with special caps and gowns is really silly and stupid. The Torah doesn't recognize such type of actions. We don't have and we don't believe in such kind of actions, and according to the Tosafists, it is strictly prohibited. So the whole institution of ceremony, according to the concept of the Torah, is a nonsensical action. And according to many authorities, it is actually prohibited. So all these kind of things stem from the primitive part of man's mind. And the Torah teaches a person to rise above that part of an individual's mind and to do things for only two reasons: either because it's rational to do the thing, it makes sense, or else because God instructed one to do so. Which again, of course, is rational, but there it's rational based upon the fact that God instructed man to do that. So those are the only two types of actions that are permissible. And that's why I mentioned last week, I said that's why B'nai Noach is the strangest religion, because it has no ritual or ceremony. And this is something which people find difficult, but that really is the beauty of the religion, because the Torah could not give the B'nai Noach any kind of mandatory performance, because it wouldn't take long until it became simply a ceremony and a ritual, not a halacha. In order to have halacha, you must have instruction. And then, of course, if there were instruction, then you'd have to have more than seven laws. You'd have to have, you know, a whole system of scholarship, and it would be mandatory to have scholarship, like it is in, like it is among the people of Israel. But the seven laws are supposed to be very basic. So therefore, what God did was, he simply did not instruct the Benoach to do anything positive, any kind of mitzvah even, because that would might become reduced to ceremony. But he gave them the option, if they wish to do a mitzvah, they can, but then of course they have to go to the Ben Israel to learn what exactly the mitzvah is and what halacha is, so that they can, when they do it, it should be an intelligent performance, not a, simply a nonsensical ceremonious act. So, this is the entire Torah stands out against any kind of primitivism or actions that are nonsensical, and that's why it's not permitted for a person is not permitted to invent his own kind of things that he does, his own kind of practices, no matter what area it might be, because that again is part of primitive man. That's the same part of man that creates religions. That the people, you know, they feel that they do certain things, or they eat certain things, or they don't eat certain things. And these things that they do make them special and closer to God. That is just primitivism and egoism, and that's what all religions try to do. And even with regard to a given law, you're not permitted to create any stipulations about it. For instance, prayer. Like, let's say, for instance, this Ben Israel or Ben Noach makes no difference. Let's say a group of Jews will get together and they'll say, well, we're gonna, you know, just us, we're gonna pray this special prayer. You know, that again is egotism and nonsensical, and it does not exist. We are allowed to. We're supposed to. That's by the way the idea of praying with a minyan, with a quorum, because it shouldn't be a private. The prayer should not be just a private affair. A person has to recognize it's not just you that prays to God. Everyone, the entire community. Is praise to God. It takes away a person from their egocentricity. But people who are egocentric like to think they're special, and either they have their own special little thing with God, or else they get a little group together and they feel that they're special people. This is really primitivism, egoism, and it's the same emotions that are responsible for man-made religions. So the Torah is very strongly opposed to that kind of a thing. That's why the Torah did not give any positive commandments to the Ben Noach, although it did leave it optional. In other words, that if the Ben Noach studies the Torah, has the opportunity to study the Torah from the Ben Israel, and he learns the commandment and he understands it, then certainly he is permitted to do it. The question, I hope that I was able to answer that. The question was originally raised with regard to the specifics of the yes.
Right. He said after you separated the political from the equation and made that he was okay with it.
Okay.
And you know making that distinction it was okay, you know he didn't have a problem with it.
Okay.
It's about time to turn the tape over, so I think we can do that. Back to what we were discussing, Marvin said after you remove the political aspect of it from it, he was okay. And I would surmise the Torah, what you said, the Torah system from the worlds that others would create, that God set natural laws into operation.
Correct.
Then he gave the principles from Torah, and mankind is to use his mind and the teaching of Torah to bring about the necessary resolve. And when they go against Torah principles because of the natural laws God established, he allows those things to transpire.
That's great.
Okay. All right. So you can proceed in whichever direction you want to go now.
Okay. I would like to, you know, I'd like to clarify a little further because I just don't want there to be any misunderstanding yet. But first, I'd just like to mention that we mentioned last week that the Maimonides says that the
the whole concept of eating the Paschal lamb and eating it in haste was because the people, there was a danger of the people if they would tarry and eating the Paschal lamb, that then the main group would leave and there would be stragglers behind and they would be open to the they'll be open to the danger of the attack from the enemies, because whenever you have a group of the people that are detached from the main group, they are in a military situation. They're in danger. So the point I want to emphasize here is, again, you see that the Torah demanded of the people a totally rational outlook, because a mystical person would say, well, look, God's saving us tonight. We don't have to worry. Look what happened. The firstborns died, and now we're going out. We can just go out any way we want. God's going to protect us. That is not true. That's what Maimonides is emphasizing, that whatever God does in the way of protection is limited to what he does. The rest, that which he does not do, you have to use your own mind, your own intelligence, and you are responsible for. Okay? Now, I do not mean to say that God never controls the laws of nature. That is not true. That again is not true. The Torah says that if the people of Israel live according to the Torah, then the rains will come in their time, in their seasons, and catastrophes will not befall them. So God does control the laws of nature, and he does intervene under the conditions which he states in the Torah, but not in any other way, okay? That's the point I'm making. And God does save individuals as well, as we know from the Torah itself, under certain conditions. But to say that God will intervene and save every innocent person, that is not what God's world is all about. So again, I am not trying to say, I don't want anyone to walk away and think that I said that the Torah preached the idea that God never intervenes with the laws of nature. That's not true. That's not true either. But the Torah teaches that under certain conditions, the existence of an individual or of a person becomes something which is necessary. And since that's the case, the laws of nature are suspended with regard to that individual or with regard to that people, under the conditions that the Torah describes. But beyond that, it's not so. And again, over here, I think in Passover is an excellent example where God did intervene, and he did suspend the laws of nature, and the children of Israel were able to leave Egypt. But again, they were responsible to make sure that they left in the most safe way possible. They could not say, well, we could just straggle along. Look, God's protecting us anyway. Look at all these miracles. So he's going to save every individual. Not true. What he said he will do, he will do. But he will not do anything beyond that. He expects you to use your mind, your intelligence, your reason. And if you do not do that, then you're going to be subject to danger and you'll be destroyed. There again, you have the concept of the swears that are mentioned in the Song of Songs, and it says in the Song of Songs, it says that you should not invoke the love until it has become desirous. And the rabbis explain what that means. Now, if you study the Talmud, you'll find what it means basically is that the Jews in the diaspora cannot just do things without sense because God is going to save them. This is not, no, the Talmud says it's the opposite. If you act that way, then what's going to happen is that your flesh is going to be given to the animals of the field, the animals of the forest, which means to say that God is not going to save you. So there is a way to act intelligently and courageously, but not foolishly. And the only time that the children of Israel can act with total confidence, without concern about the other nations, is only under a very special condition where all the people of Israel keep the law. And that's a special condition. But less, anything less than that, when that condition is, one of that condition is not there, if they try to invoke, so to speak, as this Song of Songs, but to invoke the love, they will not be successful, and they're going to be destroyed. So the point I'm making is that God has determined for us exactly, precisely how to act and how to live, and we have to follow His guidelines. We cannot just do things that we feel should be a certain way. We can't expose ourselves to dangers and expect God to protect us. Not what He said He's going to do. We have to be very careful and see what the Torah teaches insofar as what God does and insofar as what our responsibility for ourselves and our friends and our people is. That's the basic concept in the Torah. There was an argument, by the way, between it was Yoshiyahu and Isaiah, and that was the argument. That's why he got killed, because he maintained that he can act in a way that that they will be protected, because it says that the Torah says that when in the good times that the sword will not go through your land. So therefore, he went to battle, and he thought he was going to win, because he thought that God was going to be with him, because he removed all the idols. But it didn't work, because Isaiah told him, he said that it's not going to work, because the people overtly have removed the idols, but they still privately worship idols. And therefore, he wasn't successful, and he got killed. And even though he was a great person, he was not protected by God. So a person has to be very careful in the way they act. The basic premise of the whole Torah is that a person must use reason. And that's the concept of eating the paschal lamb in haste. Now, what I wanted to get into tonight a little bit, maybe there's still some time left, I wanted to get into the concept that I mentioned before, that there is no such thing as rituals in Torah. There is only halacha. Now, the people, the children of Israel, on the night of Passover, they had a lot of things to do. And, of course, it could not be done as a simple ritual. It had to be done as halacha. That being the case, Moses had to instruct the people and really teach them the fundamentals of the halacha. So the fundamentals of the halacha were really taught in the land of Egypt, on starting with the beginning of the month, with the beginning of the month of Nisan, and it continued for 2 weeks until the actual slaughtering of the Paschal lamb. Now, it's very interesting, but all those things that were done in those commandments are really laden with halachic concepts of the most basic type. And of course, it stands to reason, because any performance that had to be done by the children of Israel had to be done as halacha, and halacha is very demanding in terms of its logical structure and its concepts. So it stands to reason that Moses had to introduce the people at that time into the concept of halacha. And I mentioned last week that the rabbis derive it from one word, because it says withdraw and take a lamb. Now, what does it mean withdraw? So the word withdraw has no place there. So the rabbis say it means withdraw from idolatry and then take a lamb of mitzvah, which means that the lamb of mitzvah is a different kind of performance. This is not a ceremony. This is not a ritual. This is God's halacha, and therefore Moses had to teach the people the basic concept of halacha before they could perform the commandment. And it is rather amazing, but of course understandable, that some of the most basic principles of halacha are found in those commandments, those few commandments, that were given to the people of Israel in Egypt. Okay, Now, you know, there were two sets of commandments that were given. There were certain commandments that were given at that time, and they were not for generations. And then there are commandments there that are for generations, as you know. And I mentioned also before that the commandments that one would think would be the most suitable for reliving the Exodus are precisely the ones that were never given for generations, only given for that time. Namely, keeping your feet or your shoes on your feet and holding your staff in your hand and your waist girded and putting the blood on the doorpost and all those things that would actually would be more sensually arousing in terms of bringing back the concept of leaving Egypt. Those were omitted, basically. And eating it in haste. There's no law of eating the Paschal lamb in haste. Only that first generation. So I mentioned that the Torah does not favor the sensual and the imaginative. And that's why the Torah omitted those for generations and only left the ones that serve as vehicles of understanding and knowledge. Just from that alone, one can see the whole approach of Torah, just from that fact alone. That the approach of Torah is not to relive Egypt in a sensual way, but the concepts, the ideas, to relive it in an intellectual way. And that's why those commandments which would lend themselves most to sensual representation were really omitted for generations. But the getting back to my point before, I mentioned before, which is that some of the most basic concepts were taught to the children of Israel with regard to the Paschal Lamb. And I think it might be an idea to we can't do all of them, obviously, and we can't do them in depth either, but just to at least have an idea of what those basic concepts are. I think it's important for Ben Noach, not because Ben Noach is supposed to be studying the laws of the Paschal Lamb. That's one area that really is not in the within the scope of his study, because it's something which he doesn't partake of. But we'll see. Actually, there is a reason to say why he has to have some knowledge of it as well. But I'm just doing this in order to give you in order to demonstrate to you the idea of halacha, which a Ben Noach certainly must have. Okay. Now, you know very well that there is a concept of a positive commandment and a negative commandment. And that certainly, that concept was certainly given to the children of Israel on regarding the eve of Passover. And to take an example, a positive concept, I'm going to take the one that we have for generations. By the way, we don't know any of the details with regard to the halachic structure. We do not know the halachic structure with regard to the commandments that were only given for that first generation while they were in Egypt. The only ones that survived are the commandments that are permanent, because the oral law explained those. But the ones that were done in Egypt on that night, and it was a one-time commandment, those we do not know exactly the halachic structure of those laws. But we are fortunate that we do know the halachic structure of those laws, which are for generations. So we will stick to those. Now, positive and negative commandments is probably the most basic division of the mitzvot, the commandments of the Torah. And that, of course, you had the positive commandment, for instance, of sacrificing the lamb, and then you had the negative commandment of not eating the lamb when it was raw, partially broiled, partially cooked, or eating it when it was cooked. That was also a prohibition. That's in Exodus 12:9. Okay, so they have two negative commandments. Okay, not eating it partially roasted, which means not completely not where it's not edible, and also not eating it cooked in water. That was also a prohibition. Okay, so you have a positive and a the positive commandment of slaughtering the Paschal lamb, of eating the Paschal lamb, those two. Then you have negative commandments as well. But really, Torah is much more to the basics of Torah than just positive and negative commandments. I will give you an example. There is some, you see, just on that concept alone needs some clarification. What do we mean by positive and negative? Okay? The positive, let's say for instance when the Torah says in Leviticus, it says, these are the animals you shall eat. And then it tells you what you shall not eat. So the ones you shall not eat is negative. Now, but then it says, these are the ones that you shall eat. Okay? So when it says that, so that is called, now the question is, when it says you shall eat them, which means the kosher animals, it means you shall eat only the kosher animals, not the non-kosher. Now, is that a positive or a negative commandment? Okay? Just think about it. Not eating the non-kosher, that certainly is negative. No question about that. Okay? But now eating the kosher, where it says, these are the animals which you shall eat. These animals shall you eat. So, is that positive or is that negative? Okay? Well, the answer is that this is a special category. It's called a negative which comes out of a positive. Okay? Which means to say as follows, that you shall eat only these animals which are kosher. So actually, it is excluding the other animals, but the statement is positive, but the intent is really negative. In other words, I could tell you not to do something in two ways. I could tell you don't drink soda, or I could tell you drink only water. Okay? In both instances, I'm telling you something negative, but in one case, I'm using a positive framework, in the other case, I'm using a negative framework. Okay? So, that, by the way, is another kind of commandment, which you have over here as well. Okay? You have it in the case of, let's just leave it at this point. I'll get back to that. But, okay. I just want you to know the three categories. You have the positive, you have the negative. Okay. Now, what's the difference between a true positive commandment, for instance, putting on phylacteries, which is a true positive commandment, or the commandment of eating kosher animals? Why do I say in one instance it's a true positive commandment, in the other instance I say, well, it's not really, it's really a negative, but it's expressed in the positive. Okay? How do I determine whether it is a true positive commandment or whether it's merely something negative but it's expressed in a positive way? Okay? I have to have some way of determining this. So I don't know what the category is, because there are basically three categories. You have the negative, which is expressed negatively, you have the positive, which is expressed positively, and then you have a negative, which is expressed in a positive way. Like the case where I said, drink only water, which would mean the exclusion of soda. Okay. Same thing with the Torah says, eat only these animals. Okay? Now that's a negative. It means don't eat the other animals. It's a negative, but expressed in a positive way. Now how do I differentiate between those two cases? A simple question. Okay? These are some of the basics of halacha. Okay, because halacha is a system which has fundamental principles, and now we're dealing with some of these fundamentals. The answer is as follows. The answer is, there is a very simple way to tell whether you're dealing with a true positive or whether you're dealing with a negative, but it's just being expressed in the positive. Okay? The way that you can tell is, if there is some kind of fulfillment, so then it's a true positive. Okay? If there is no fulfillment, then it's not a true positive, it's a negative. All right, now let's take each one of these cases. In the case where the Torah says put on phylacteries, is there a fulfillment? The answer is obviously yes. That's the fulfillment, to put on the phylacteries. But what about the case where the Torah says eat the kosher animals? These are the ones you shall eat. Is there a positive fulfillment? Okay, well, the answer is very simple. If every time I eat a kosher animal, I'm fulfilling a mitzvah, okay, I'm fulfilling God's commandment, then it would be positive, which would mean that I should eat meat. I should eat animals. I should eat kosher animals. So then every day, or whenever the time period might be, I must sit down and eat a kosher animal. Now, that's where the oral law comes in and explains the written law, because you could interpret the written law that way. If a person would just read it literally, it says, these animals you shall eat. So a person could say, okay, so every day I have to eat some animal, you see. But the oral law explains to us that that's not the case, that God is not instructing people to eat meat. They don't have to eat meat. If you want to eat, you want to eat vegetables, that's also fine, okay? So therefore, there is nothing positive in that commandment. There is no fulfillment, in other words. So, in other words, since there is no fulfillment, so what does that prove? It proves that it is not a true positive commandment, because a true positive always has a fulfillment. It proves that it is a negative. In other words, the Torah is saying, eat only these. When you eat, eat only these. Never eat the others. So the objective is on the never eat the others. But it's expressing it in the positive. It's saying, limit your food to these. You don't have to eat them, but limit it to them. So therefore, it is a negative commandment being expressed in the positive form. Okay? So now we have the formula, a very simple formula of how you can identify these commandments. Whether it's a positive, true positive, whether it's a negative, true negative, or whether it is a negative, but it's being expressed in a positive manner. Okay? The criterion is very simple. If there is a fulfillment, then it's a true positive. If there is no fulfillment, so then it is simply a negative, but it's being expressed in a positive manner. And that, of course, to determine that, one cannot determine from reading the Bible itself, because you just don't know. The literal meaning could be both ways. And that's why one must make recourse to the oral law to determine whether or not it is whether there is a fulfillment here, in other words, you should do this, or whether it's merely saying, limit yourself to this range, to this area. Okay, so that is one of the most basic principles of Torah, the positive, the negative, and the negative, which is expressed in the positive. Okay, we have all three over here. Interesting. We have all three in the night of Passover. I showed you the positive and the negative, and now I'm going to show you where you have the negative, which is expressed in a positive manner. Okay, and that is in chapter 12, verse 8. Okay, the law is as follows. The law is that he says you should eat the meat on that night. Okay? Now, let us say a person, the sacrifice of the Paschal lamb was done in the daytime. All sacrifices are done in the daytime. Sacrifice is never done at night. So the sacrifice of the Paschal lamb was done in the daytime, after midday. Now, it says you should eat the meat on that night, which means that you are not permitted to eat it when? You're not permitted to eat it till nightfall. So if a person should eat it during the daytime, so what happens is the person has violated a negative law, even though it's being expressed in the positive, okay? Because it says you should eat the meat on that night, okay? Which means to say, only that night, all right, to the exclusion of the daytime. So therefore, if the person would eat it during the day before nightfall, he would be in violation, in halachic violation, of doing something which he's not supposed to do, which means negative. In other words, when you do something you're not supposed to do, that's negative. Even though it's being expressed, however, in the positive, because it says, eat it during that night. Okay. Now, there is another concept over here, which I wish to introduce, and that is the concept of failing to do a positive, all right, which we have spoken about before, all right? In other words, the idea that when there's a positive commandment, if you fail to do it, okay, so then you are in violation of halacha, right? The positive commandment. Now, what I want to show you is that I'm going to show you another case where you have right over here, you have the one next to the other, you have a negative and a positive, and that's the very next verse in 12:9. Okay, in 12:9 it says like this: do not eat from it when it is partially cooked, or if it is cooked in water. And then it says, only, you should eat only that which is broiled on the fire. Okay? And then it says, its head with its knees, the legs, in other words, and the innards. Okay. Now, when it says, The oral law teaches us that let's say, for instance, now what would happen if a person ate it raw? Okay? So if a person ate it raw, he's not in violation of the first negative, which is don't eat it partially cooked, because it's not partially cooked. It's raw. Okay? And then let's say he's also not in violation of the second law, correct? Which is not to eat it cooked, because again, it's not cooked. It's raw. So he bypassed those two violations. But he's going to get caught when it comes to that third part of the statement, where it says, you shall only eat it roasted. Which means to say that he's failing. How is he failing? He is failing insofar as fulfilling the positive commandment of eating it roasted. Okay? So therefore, over here, we have, if the person eats it